A quick reminder before we get to today's episode, the science Kickstarter is underway. So if you aren't familiar with science, listen to this quick description of the graphic novel from writers Jason Inman and Ashley Victoria Robinson. It's a book I'm really excited about. I can't wait to get my hands on it and share it with my 7-year-old daughter. I think that Ashley and Jason are great writers, and their passion for comics is obvious, and it shows in the quality of their books. So take a quick listen and go pledge and share the Kickstarter with all your friends. Let's talk about your new Kickstarter. What's it all about?
It's called Science with an exclamation point.
So you gotta say it like that.
You gotta say it like Science.
Yeah, there you go. You gotta clip everybody's microphone when you say it.
Take care about that, everybody. Wake up.
Yeah. It stars a 14-year-old girl named Tamsin Trecru. It's more of a middle grade story, whereas Jupiter Jet was more of an all age story. So I guess that means it's a little bit edgier in the type of storytelling. But she is attending the Prometheus Institute. And it's the most amazing kind of school that has cute little robots called stats that fly around. It's got experimental physics. It's got amazing labs. But Tamsin's maybe not as happy to be there as she should be. And that's because her dead father used to be the headmaster there, and working there is what took him from her. So she's determined to, take the school down from the inside, like a normal teenager would want to do.
It's Harry Potter if Harry Potter wanted to destroy Hogwarts. There you go.
Tamsin is driven not only by, the trauma that comes along with losing a parent, but her father was a real smart science guy and downloaded his consciousness into her super cool glasses. So she actually sees a projection of him, and he can see everything that she's doing. And he's leading her on this quest, but he can also see like her interactions with her cute roommate, Garen, which is not what you want your dad to see when you're 14.
And the thing is, too, is that her father actually died when she was 3. So she never knew her father. The only father she has known is this holographic version of her father that has sort of existed around her. Science is a story that we think is pretty unique. I don't think there is a sort of teenager-y Star Trek science fiction-y with real facts out there. And if you like Jupiter Jet and you like our podcast, you like any of our tone, then I guarantee you're going to like this. You're going to like our flavor. And you hear about our passion for comics. Everything we do is how much we love comic books. And we inject that into our comics. Like, I think when you read our comics, especially Jupiter Jet and our stuff in the If anthologies and Love is Love, you can feel that love pouring through. And Science is the exact same thing. So if that doesn't convince you to buy Science or help us pre-order or make this book, then I don't know what will.
All right. If that sounds like something you might be interested in, I highly encourage you to go and check out the Kickstarter for Science. The good news is that in less than 36 hours, the Kickstarter was fully funded. So what that means for you, as someone who goes and does a pledge, you are guaranteed to get the book, right? Like, a lot of times you see something, a Kickstarter, you're excited, you pledge, and it doesn't get fully funded. And you're not out any cash, but you wanted the book. That's why you pledged in the first place. So you don't have to worry about that with Science. It's fully funded, and now we're on to stretch goals, right? And if you listen to our previous Spotlight episode on Science, you'll know that Jason and Ashley, the first thing they're going to do with any stretch goals they meet is add more content, more pages, more story. So again, I think it's completely worthwhile. I've already pledged. Go over there, do yourself a favor, and check it out. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 515 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. It's time for another Superman Sunday episode. Today, we're actually going to be talking about Supergirl number 22. If you've been following along with the Superman Sunday podcast, you'll know we previously covered Supergirl 21. And you'll also remember how closely that ties into the Brian Michael Bendis Man of Steel miniseries that previously was released by DC. Basically,
Supergirl has taken it upon herself to go out into space and find out the truth about Rogozar. So I have Adam from Talking Superman joining me today. Thanks for joining me, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you weren't able to come on when we covered Supergirl 21. So first of all, let me ask, had you been reading Supergirl before the Rogozar stuff?
I read, I believe, like the first two or three arcs of Steve Orlando's run, and I'm not all caught up pre-Rogel storyline.
Yeah, so I was kind of the same way. I think I read the first arc. I don't think I read the second arc, and if I did, I only read the first couple. I didn't finish it. I felt like they were kind of trying to give it the same sort of sensibility that the TV show had, which makes total sense. It I don't feel like that's necessarily aimed at me, and I'm not a big enough Supergirl fan that I stuck with it. That's kind of, did you kind of feel the same way, that that's the sensibility they were going for?
I did. I mean, it's hard not to when they start introducing, you know, the same characters and the CEO and everything, or DEO. What's the alien?
I don't know. Yeah, I think
office?
I think it's DEO, but I'm not even sure.
All right, you know what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, but I thought it worked, but it's just they always kind of struggle to get a take for Supergirl that just 100% clicks, I think, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I agree, because I think she's a great character, but she's one of those that has to be done right, and the fact that they have tried so many different things in the past. I mean, she's no Hawkman, but you know, cousin from you know, Krypton, you know, Earth 2 with Power Girl, they brought in for a little while. That, you know, they did the Matrix thing where she was like from another universe and this protoplasm. Then we had the whole Peter David where she was like this crazy angel thing that like merged with Kara. It's like, all right, can we just get one Supergirl and stick with her, right?
Right.
For me, the way I looked at it was, yeah, Supergirl, probably not for me. Maybe I'll get caught up on it, you know, someday. You know, I was still getting preview copies, so I had them to check out, you know, when I got a chance. But then when I heard that they, well, first of all, they said, okay, canceled along with the Super Sons, because Brian Michael Bendis was going to handle the whole Superman corner of the universe. And then after the first couple issues of Man of Steel came out, they said, oh, wait, we're bringing Supergirl back. We're bringing back Adventures of Super Sons as a 12-issue limited. But what we're going to do with Supergirl is, they told us straight out, right from the beginning, she's going to be out in space. She's going to be looking for the truth about Rogozar. I'm curious about the truth of Rogozar. You know, I'm still not 100% if I like the character or not, but I'm very curious about the origins and the history of him. And the other thing that really sold me was I saw these incredible costume designs from Terry Dodson and Kevin Maguire that gave her a different look, a look we'd never seen her have before. And they were so cool looking. I'm, you know what? I'm really going to have to pick this up. And plus it was Mark Andreyko writing, who I feel is a very good writer, kind of underrated in my opinion. And so I was like, yeah, for sure, I'm going to have to pick this up. And for me, the issue 21, the first issue, blew me away. It was so exceeded my expectations. I was like, yeah, I'm definitely in for this. At what point did you say, all right, I'm going to start reading Supergirl again?
You know what? I think it's a pretty similar story to yours. I saw the designs. I think Jorge Jimenez, or no. Who's doing Justice League right now? That guy.
Yeah, Jorge Jimenez and Jim Chung.
Okay, yes. Yeah, so yeah, I think they did the designs. I saw those. I loved them. Loved how different they were. Love how we have other options now, depending on what she's doing. I love that something about her having a giant battle axe kind of worked for me.
Yeah, and the other thing was, and this is going to sound so weird coming from me, because I usually like my Superman to be more on the bright side of things. You know, I do think that he represents hope and optimism and that kind of ideal. But this is not Superman. This is Supergirl. And she always has been more on that bright, optimistic side. There's been various stories, especially if you add in things like the Man of Steel movie, Batman versus Superman, where different, in different media, where different creators have tried to give Superman an edge. I don't feel like that necessarily works. Sometimes it does. Sometimes if you give him just a little bit of edge, it's okay, but it's a very fine line to walk. I think there's a greater margin for error when you do that with Supergirl. And I did feel like from the description that they gave about what Kara was going to be doing, that you could kind of tell there was going to be an undercurrent of she's kind of pissed off. She's not a happy camper, and she wants to find out what the heck is going on.
So we're seeing her with this edge. You know, she's not a happy camper. She's heard from Rogolzar that he's responsible for the death of Krypton. And in the first issue of this storyline, 21, that we talked about last time, she's talking to Clark. She's talking to Superman about it. And she says, to you, Krypton is just an ideal. It's just this heritage, this legacy that you have, but it's not really real because you were a baby when you left. For me, I remember Krypton. I remember my loved ones. I remember my family. I remember my friends. And so for her, it's much more personal. And being that Andreyko and the rest of the creative team are going to be telling this story, but it's also going to be a little bit of an edge because this is very personal to Kara. And again, I just feel like we've never really seen her, at least not that I remember, with as much of an edge. I mean, maybe when she was a Red Lantern, but I didn't read that stuff. So I haven't ever read her where she's not just full of hope and optimism and looking to be not just a hero and save people, but also empathize and sympathize with people, because I know that was a big part of Steve Orlando's run, because he told me that himself, that he felt like a big part of the character was the fact that she doesn't just want to stop criminals or villains from doing bad things. She wants to find out why they're doing them and help them become better people. I don't think she has much interest in helping Rogolzar become a better person. She wants the truth, and she, as we've seen in these first two issues, and we'll talk about 22 here in a second, she seems like she doesn't really care who stands in her way, good or bad guy. She's going to find the truth. So for me, that's what has me so excited about the story, Supergirl with an edge. Do you feel any of that, or is it another reason that you're excited? Is it just the Rogolzar thing?
Yeah, I like everything you said. I feel like that's something I haven't really thought about Supergirl before, is that she has a little bit more wiggle room with her, you know, kind of rage. I haven't read the Red Lantern stuff either, but people do recommend it to me. I know people like it. I don't think anything of it is completely out of character there or here. I guess it's just, we'll see later if we get that kind of compassion side later, because I do like that side too.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like that could make for a more compelling and realistic story if Andreyko does bring that back. I mean, right now, everything is still fresh, right? She just recently found out about Rogolzar. She's out there trying to find the truth. Now, if she finds out that, and we find out as readers, that there is more of a sympathetic aspect to Rogolzar, like he's really kind of been put through the ringer, and we could kind of understand why. I mean, maybe Kryptonians killed his family, and then that would make it a little, or killed his race, or something, right? Something where we can kind of understand what his motivations are. Because right now, he's a bit of a mustache-twirling villain, right? Like, destroy all Kryptonians, and we don't understand why. So it makes it hard to relate to him. And if we find out later that there's a motivation behind it that we can relate to, that would probably be the same situation Kara would find herself in. And then Andreyko could really come over the top with that empathy side of Kara and really show what makes her a hero. So it's all speculation at this point, though.
Right.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and I'm not going to go as in-depth as we usually do on the synopsis, but we're going to do a little different this time. I'm going to go over the events of the issue, and we're going to actually talk about the if there's anything we want to say about any of the kind of, we'll do page by page rather than going through the whole issue and then going back a second time and talking about the parts we want to talk about. So we're just going to kind of do the synopsis and the analysis kind of all in one this time. I just wanted to try something different. So we see that Kara is on her way to MOGO, the headquarters of the Green Lantern Corps, They are the peacekeepers of the universe, as it were. And we saw in issue 21, last issue, that Kara had taken the battle axe to Hal Jordan and had him scan it. And Hal was, he didn't think that he was going to find anything. He's like, you know, Superman brought this to me before, had me scan it, and I couldn't find anything. So he was very skeptical. And Kara's like, for me, will you scan it again? But this time, instead of just scanning the symbol on the axe, scan the whole axe. So rather than the Green Lantern database, which supposedly is the most knowledgeable and largest database in the universe, rather than it come back with nothing found like before, it said something like, you don't have the authority to view these files. It's all redacted. And Hal's like shocked, like, but I'm Hal Jordan. I'm like the greatest of the Green Lanterns. How could something be hidden from me? It was kind of an interesting moment. And McGuire did a great job of showing that surprise, that surprise on Hal's face. So Kara decides, well, this is where I'm going to start. I'm going to take the axe. I'm going to go to Mogo and I'm going to get the answers that are there. I'm going to get that information that's in the database and see for myself. And she takes some equipment. She doesn't fly because, you know, not necessarily a yellow sun everywhere in the galaxy. So she takes the last of the Kryptonian flyers that weren't destroyed there in the Fortress of Solitude. She takes some equipment. Crypto goes with her. She takes some other costumes that are supposed to hold solar energy. So if her cells are completely full, the costume will hold extra for her, basically. And that's where issue 22 picks up. And as she approaches Mogo, she finds the Green Lantern Corps to be fighting against a bunch of warriors from Kord, which I didn't even know that they were necessarily a thing anymore, but here they are. And before I go any further on this first splash page, when we see the Lanterns and the Kordians fighting, it does have the creative team as well. Written by Mark Andraco, pencils by Kevin McGuire, inks by Sean Parsons, colors by FCO Placencia, and letters by Tom Napolitano. And there's also a great cover by Terry and Rachel Dodson, and a variant cover by Amanda Connor with Paul Mounts. So Kara kind of skirts the battle, which right from the start, I found that interesting, that she's thinking about, you know, basically all the stuff I just told you about how she's heading to Mogo to get answers, and that would include the redacted files that Hal found but couldn't read. And that's what she's focused on, to the point where, like, you would think Kara would be like, oh, fight? Oh, the Green Lanterns are fighting these Kordians? Let me go and help, right? No, she's singularly focused. And she says she's actually afraid of the answers that she'll find. Was Krypton actually murdered and it wasn't a natural disaster? How does she deal with that? How does she, and credit Andraco, again, he is putting a little bit of that empathy in here, and showing that she does always try to understand her her enemies. She says, I mean, is there even a way to understand such unbridled hatred? So even as she's out searching for the truth, and could Rogolzar be behind the destruction of Krypton, she's still thinking, could I understand where he's coming from? Could I understand that hate? To understand hate of an entire species so much that you'd want to wipe it out of existence, how does Rogolzar happen? So she's hoping that the Green Lanterns will readily share the information they have. But she does start thinking, is this some kind of intergalactic conspiracy? Because that's how things happen. And who knows? Rogolzar could have just lied about it all. He could have just been trying to elicit a reaction or distract Superman or throw him off. So either way, she's going to find the answers. And as they approach the planet, Krypto wakes up and he starts growling, and Supergirl's like, what is it? What's going on with him? And before she can figure it out, the ship kind of goes out of control, and she's trying to understand what's going on. The ship's telling her that the internal gravity has failed, directional control has failed. So she tells the ship to drop the accelerators to 0% and scan for malfunction, and the ship's troubleshooting for a cause and it's scanning. Supergirl and Krypto are being thrown about the cabin, and the ship tells her that there's an alien power source that's causing the system failure, And before anything else can happen, there's a giant energy release from the axe and the ship explodes. So right away, Kara and Crypto they're not starting this trip off in the best of circumstances, right? Because Kara knows that this search could take her all across the galaxy, and that's why she took the ship, in case there's not a yellow sun, in case she doesn't have the ability to fly. She doesn't have the ability to travel long distances in space because she can only hold her breath. It's not like old school pre-crisis Superman and Supergirl where they could just travel in space indefinitely. She needs to breathe. You know, she may be able to hold her breath for half an hour, which is pretty super, but doesn't mean she can actually breathe. And so that's the where she's starting her trip off, already kind of behind the eight ball. It'd be like one of us going on this like quest. I'm going to go on this journey to find ourselves, and we get 3 miles from our house and our car breaks down, catches on fire and burns. You're like, oh, how am I supposed to continue this quest? I think for most of us, we'd probably just turn around, walk back home. But Kara's made of a little sterner stuff than that. She does want her answers. So she does grab the battle axe, and she's trying to think of how she and Crypto can get down to the surface. And it's interesting, the first time she goes to grab the battle axe, there's a little zap. It zaps her. And she makes this, again, credit the art of Kevin Maguire, shows her being zapped. And then she literally takes one finger and she's making a strange face as she's touching it, doesn't want to get zapped again, and is able to touch it and then grab it. And as she does, she's surrounded by a green bubble. And we see that John Stewart and Kyle Rayner and Chip are there and wondering what the heck Kara's doing out here on the edges of Mogo's atmosphere, and why she had something to do with an unknown level 5 power source. That's why they're there. They were Mogo detected the explosion. And John Stewart says, wasn't what I was expecting to find. And Kyle says, yeah, Supergirl, if you wanted our attention, all you had to do was call. You didn't have to blow up your own ship. And Kara kind of snaps at Kyle. She's like, you think this was intentional? I'm going to risk Crypto in my life to call out to the green welcome wagon. And then she realizes that she, you know, temper, temper. Kyle's like, sorry, it was just a joke. And John Stewart, I love it. He mutters, shut up, Kyle. This isn't helping. And so they say, well, let's get down to the atmosphere so we can actually have a conversation. So again, Kara's not starting off in the greatest place. And I wonder, what the heck was it about that the axe exploded with this energy in the first place? And secondly, does it have some kind of sentience that when Kara first tried to grab it, it zapped her? What do you think?
That's a good question. I have no idea. I mean, we'll see later as more, you know, tricks up its sleeve. It just seems like it, maybe not sentient, but needs to bond with someone.
That's a good theory. And again, you wonder if it might not necessarily be sentient, but it is programmed a certain way. Like self-defense kind of mechanisms built in. So it was wrapped up. It was placed in the hold of this ship. It was basically on lockdown. It didn't like that. And so, yeah, it exploded. Why did it take so long? Well, who knows? Maybe it had something to do with sensing all the Green Lanterns around and considered them hostile. Let me go ahead and explode. And then same thing. It hasn't bonded with Kara yet. So when she tries to grab it, it zaps her. There's clearly a lot more than meets the eye to this axe, and as Adam said, we'll see a little more of that in this issue later. So, as Kara and John Stewart, Kyle Rayner, and Chip and Crypto all head down to the atmosphere of Mogo, John's asking her why she's there, personal and professional, and she's like, "Well, both doing some research." And John's asking her to elaborate. She says, "Well, it's kind of boring, Kryptonian stuff, ancient files." I want to know some details about its seismic activity. And all along, she's not telling them everything because she doesn't know if this information that's being withheld if it's an inside job. So John says, well, anything we, you know, you need is yours. The archive will probably have it. If the archive doesn't, it probably didn't happen. So they head to the archive and they meet the little creature that we saw last issue when Hal Jordan tried to access the information. And you can tell he's nervous that Kara is there and has the axe. And the little creature's name's Sizzal. And John Stewart instructs him to give Kara anything she needs and takes off. And so Sizzal takes Kara into the archive and kind of shows her around. And meanwhile, Kara notices kind of a restricted area where she sees a Green Lantern entering a code to get in. Meanwhile, Sizzal's like, your walking staff, it's very interesting. Is that what I think it is? And he's looking at the symbol. And Kara's like, don't touch it. And it zaps Sizzal just like it zapped her. But as he touches it, it literally transforms into an axe, like an axe that we would consider an axe. It's not some giant 6.5 foot tall battle axe anymore. It's just, it looks almost like a hatchet. And Sizzal said, did you know it did that? And Kara's like, of course, thinking to herself, not. And then Kara's saying, you know what, I'm feeling a little bit tired. Can we do all the paperwork tomorrow? And Sizzal says, sure. And Kara's thinking, well, it's pretty cool that this axe now has a travel size. I can carry it under my cape. I wish I knew how it worked, right? I wish there was like an owner's manual. So later that night, the axe is on a shelf in her quarters where she's staying. Crypto's there. And we see a robed figure pick up the axe and wander over to the archives. And we find out it's Kara, and she's wearing this red and black hooded costume. So again, maybe a little bit of overshadowing of this dark path that she's taking. So again, we know next to nothing about the axe. And I do wonder how much of what's going on with the axe and the history and origin behind it, I wonder how much that's Bendis and how much that's Andraco. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I even wonder how much of it was Jim Lee in designing the thing, because I've seen his original designs for Rogel and has little notes like, hey, maybe this skull can talk, stuff like that.
That's interesting. I find it very interesting, especially considering what happens here in a few pages. So we'll have to keep reading to find out. So Kara, I mentioned earlier that she had seen one of the other Green Lanterns enter a code to have access to this restricted archive space. So she goes in and she's blown away by just how much data is here and it's all stored. And I will say this, because I work IT, right? And it has a lot to do with computers and technology and everything. And we're so far advanced being able to store things, centralize the cloud, as it's called. And so when I see things like Rogue One, where these super secure plans for a Death Star that need to, you know, not ever be stolen or whatever, are literally on a physical hard drive in a certain space, it always makes me laugh because it doesn't make any sense. And I feel a little bit of the same way about this giant physical database of the Green Lantern Corps, right? They're so far advanced of us. Like, why would they need to physically store this stuff? But for the sake of the story, it definitely works. So Kara's wondering, where do I even begin? And before she can even start looking around, the axe starts humming and there's a guard, Green Lantern, that shows up saying, how did you get in here? And before she can answer, she's like, hold that thought. And the Green Lantern's like, you brought a weapon in here? There's no weapons allowed in here. The axe changes shape again to a dual-sided battle axe that's red and glowing. It's much bigger than anything we've seen before. And kind of the red and black color of it, the shape of it, it looks almost demonic and hostile, and it literally tries to start destroying these databases, the physical memory storage that's in this room that Kara has entered. And the Green Lantern's like, initiate defensive
And Kara's like, no, get out of the way. And she does manage to hold it back from smashing into this Green Lantern mere inches from its face. And she's using all her strength to hold it back. And she's like, it must think that I'm in danger to be reacting this way, but it's what's dangerous. I really do need an owner's manual for this thing. I've got to get it out of here before someone gets hurt. And then a lot more Green Lanterns show up, including John Stewart. And wondering, Kara, what are you doing? You're trespassing a restricted location. Stop being aggressive. Explain yourself. Drop your weapon. Kara's like, I don't think you want me to let go of this thing. And Kara's like, I'm going to need backup. And she yells for Crypto, who she left behind in her quarters sleeping on her bed. And he wakes up. And I love the panel, the last panel on the page, where it's just some speed lines to show just how fast Crypto, once he realizes Kara's in trouble, like speeds over to help her out. And again, the Green Lanterns. Oh, did you want to say something, Adam?
No. Yeah, you're good. Keep going.
So the Green Lanterns are continuing to tell her, hey, stop, disarm. And she's like, I'm trying, I'm on your side. She's like, well, you broke the rules just entering the Lantern database with a weapon that's buzzing with at a highly explosive rate. So being that you brought a weapon here kind of suggests otherwise that you're not on our side. And so the Green Lanterns kind of shackle the axe to hold it in place. And Kara's like, you don't understand. I'm not. That'll never happen. That'll never work. And she's like, oh, wait, it worked. You guys were able to neutralize the axe. And at that moment, when things just at the moment they start to calm down and maybe get a handle on things, Crypto shows up and whaps into all three of the lanterns, which they release control, the shackles they have on the axe, and it starts spitting flame and with a big whoosh. And Kara's like, now what? Everybody stay back. I don't know what weird energy the axe is pulling in. And the Green Lanterns are telling her, you can't escape. Backup's on the way. Surrender. And Kara's like, it's not letting me let go. And then she says, Krypton, be a good boy. And she disappears in a big flash. And the Green Lanterns are like, well, that was unusual. What was that? And we see apparently that Kara has been transported somewhere, because we're seeing the lantern that we saw, or the guardian rather, that we saw at the beginning of the Man of Steel miniseries that was part of that Galactic Council, the one that Rogelzar appealed to about destroying Krypton. And the one that then came and told Rogelzar that Krypton had been destroyed and he should lay low. So it's Apa Ali Apsa. And we know he's dead because he says, welcome, traveler. If you're seeing this, I'm no more. But I've been complicit in some crimes, and this is my last testament. So it seems to me, and I'm and this is how the issue ends. Right. He also does mention that there was a cabal, which he was a member, and it was what unleashed Rogelzar. And this is basically his confession. The hands of the cabal are bloodied with the blood of billions, known as the Circle. And now their day of reckoning is at hand. So you wonder how many of them are still around. And maybe that will be Kara's mission, to go and hunt them down before she even gets to Rogelzar. She wants to understand the motivations and the kind of the men behind the assassin, so to speak. But what's interesting, and what I speculate as this issue ends, is that Apsa thought at some point Rogelzar is going to be defeated. And his hope was that somebody would bring that weapon, would bring Rogelzar's weapon to the database, you know, put two and two together, bring it to the database, and then when the axe was in proximity of the database, that it would somehow transport the bearer of the axe, or whoever brought it, to this little pocket space where they would have access to the data of his will. That's kind of what I think is happening. Obviously, we don't know for sure. We may find out more in the next issue. But that's kind of my idea, right? And this is exactly the information that Sazal and the rest of the Circle didn't want Kara to find,
But I don't think they necessarily knew what was in it. They probably, because again, you needed the axe to access it. So they probably just knew, and again, I'm totally speculating here. They probably just knew that, yeah, Apa Ali Apsa left something behind, left this last will and testament. And being that he was somebody who was more sympathetic to Tsar and wasn't quite so evil, I don't want to say evil, but manipulative as a part of the cabal. Maybe he even spoke out against him at some point, that they were worried he was the weak link that would confess. And so they knew that, yeah, he left some kind of message behind and we have to be sure that it's never found because it's going to make us look bad, right? So again, it's all speculation, but that's my guess. What are your thoughts, Adam?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure. I'm just trying to think actually who could still be alive in the circle, because we know, is Starfire's dad still alive?
No, not as far as I know. I mean, that was why her sister fought, right, to see who was going to be
okay. The
ruler after he died.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I'm a little baffled, to be honest with you. I haven't thought of it being used as kind of a key to get to the last testament here. If that makes sense to me.
Well, the other thing we could possibly think about is nobody from that circle that we saw in Man of Steel may be alive, but there may still be a circle.
Right.
There may be, you know, others have taken the place. There may still be a circle out there right now who are attempting to pull strings and kind of control things. And we never really did find out their motivation, but it did sound like from context in the Man of Steel series that they had done some things that wouldn't be looked upon as that nice to most people. You know, I kind of almost think of them as maybe the DC Universe version of the Illuminati from over on the Marvel side of things, where it's these powerful beings who are taking it upon themselves to make decisions for a greater whole. And really, like, what authority do they have to make these decisions? And it's one thing to say, well, we're making decisions that are for the greater good, but some people are going to die, right? So we're going to save the entire universe, but 10,000 people are going to die, right? That's from a logical standpoint, from a standpoint of utilitarianism, that's a great choice. But if you're one of those 10,000 people that have to die for the rest of the universe to live, that's not a good choice for you. And what do you care if the universe survives, because you're not there? So that's kind of how I take the circle to be. And for all we know, they may have made other choices that were just downright evil. It remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think I read the circle to be that malicious at the time when I was reading them, but I might have to go back and really pick apart their motive.
Yeah, I didn't really read them as good or bad necessarily.
Right.
I read them as being very pragmatic. But again, there may have been decisions they made for the greater good that did harm some people. And kind of if you look at it in the context of the way Superman or Supergirl is going to look at it, Superman's always going to look for he's not going to look for the hardest path or the hardest solution. He's going to look for the solution that saves the most lives. And if that happens to be the hardest solution or the toughest road to follow, he doesn't care. That might not be the same as the circle. They may have made decisions that, we're going to try to maximize the ease at which we can accomplish this. And we're not that worried about maximizing and kind of holding life sacred. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I guess we'll just have to see what decisions the circle did make and whether, you know, I'm sure the sins of the circle are going to come forward, and maybe that is how we'll connect with Rogel, is we find out that he's not the worst guy in this history.
Right, exactly. That he may have been manipulated as well.
Right.
I do wonder, and I didn't notice this, and I think this is a credit to Bendis.
in the 6-issue series, the axe was such a big part of him. Whenever he fought in battle, he would use the axe prominently. In the Superman title, he's in the Phantom Zone right now. He doesn't have the axe, but he's managed to wipe out or subdue the other denizens of the Phantom Zone relatively easily without his axe. And I didn't think of that until just now, just how it wasn't that I felt like he relied on it in the Man of Steel, but it did seem like a part of him almost. He's apparently just as powerful without it. He acquits himself very well in the Phantom Zone when he fights the other denizens of it there, the other prisoners. But it's going to be interesting to see him fight against Superman. We assume that's coming up in Superman 4 with the way 3 ended. If Superman will have a little bit of easier time, because the axe did seem to give Rogol, Zar, an edge whenever they fought before.
Yeah, that's true. I guess that adds more motive to why he would need to gather an army.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you wonder, if he does escape, will he try to stop Kara from finding out the truth? Or would he want Kara to know the truth? Would he want Kara to know that the circle exists and isn't necessarily benevolent? Or would he just want to go and get his axe back and kill her? That's something interesting to think about as well.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, she did mention in the beginning wondering how a Rogolzar happened. So I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of this arc, she does sympathize with him a little bit.
Yeah, and again, it would be a way to stay true to her character, but still, as I said, give her a bit of an edge to tell a little bit of a different Supergirl story. So yeah, I'm loving this story so far. To me, this is some of the best Supergirls. I mean, I know it's only 2 issues, but this is some of the best Supergirl I've ever read.
Yeah, I agree, actually. Like we said in the beginning, you know, she's struggled getting her own sort of take that works 100%. And I think that her being the super family member that just goes full cosmic with a little, you know, dash of crypto in there is that's the take that works for her, for me.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I do also find it interesting, and it makes total sense that she isn't willing to explain herself even to people that she knows. Like, there is nothing that's going to stand in the way of her finding out the truth. And the fact that this Green Lantern database wasn't able to be accessed and the information was redacted and hidden and locked away, that immediately raised her suspicions. And she's going to play everything really close to the vest and not let anybody know what she's up to, even people she's known and trusted in the past, because she's got this single-mindedness of purpose that I want to find out 100% of the truth and I want to understand what happened. That's, again, a big departure from Kara, because she's been pretty trusting in the past.
Yeah, I wonder about that, because it does seem to me, I kind of got the sense that people trust her, but like, you know, John Stewart seems a little still on the edge with her. They kind of sense that something's not right here.
Well, yeah, because I think in a way she's acting a little bit out of character, because she can't help but be a little bit on edge because of what her mission is, right? Just like when they first meet her outside Mogo's atmosphere, and Kyle Rayner makes a joke, and we know Kyle Rayner makes jokes. He does that all the time. And instead of kind of laughing or being playful back, she like snaps at him, and they're like, whoa, what is going on here, right? So I think that because they know her, they do sense there's something going on, there's something different. So they're probably a little baffled by the way that she's acting, and especially now that they've seen her, you know, in the chamber. So you wonder if when she finds out this information from Opsa, and I imagine she'll come back to Mogo, if she'll explain, or if Opsa will, the data or the will, last will and testament of Opsa that was left behind, if it will transport her somewhere else, then she'd be leaving crypto behind. I don't know. It's tough to speculate on what's going to happen next. which is really a sign of a great story. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I can't wait to find out.
There's so many questions being raised, and that it's complimenting the Superman book so much because of it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. What do you think of the art, Kevin Maguire?
I wanted to say this is the issue where I've never seen so many facial expressions in one issue before, and they're all great.
Yeah, Kevin Maguire's kind of known for being able to be very expressive with the face, and he's continuing that here, probably to another level, as Adam said. And I talked last issue about the fact that Maguire's art on this series seems to be a little cleaner than it has been in the past, maybe a little bit less detail. And I wondered if that had something to do with his inking partner on this, Sean Parsons. And I said, if that's the case, then Maguire and Parsons need to always be together, kind of like Alan Davis and Mark Farmer or John Byrne and Terry Austin. It's like a classic combination here. They go together so well. I don't know if that's actually the case. I was talking to Don Sparrow, who's been on the show before. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it today. But he was talking about that, him being an artist himself, about how Maguire's going with a little less detail, a little more cartoony, and how well it was working for him. But so again, I'm not sure what exactly it is. If it is Sean Parsons kind of cleaning up, or if Maguire's just trying a little bit different style. I'm going to see Kevin in a few weeks at New York Comic Con. I'm definitely going to sit down for a chat with him about Supergirl. And so I'll be sure and ask him that. But for me, this is – and remember that Kevin Maguire did a long run on Justice League, the Bwahaha era, with Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. That's classic stuff. It's one of the best eras of Justice League ever, and he was the penciler on it for a huge chunk of it, and it's revered and rightly so. That being said, that gorgeous Justice League art, as amazing as it was, and as expressive with the facial expressions and action and storytelling, everything. It was great, right? To me, these two issues of Supergirl are the best thing Kevin Maguire's ever done.
That's
how good this art is. I mean, it is just...
I agree. It is cleaner, like you said.
Well, not only that, he's showing more emotion than I've ever seen him show through facial expressions. And it's not just the expressions on the face. It's the way he sequentially is going through and telling a story where there's little to no dialogue from Andrako. There's not any need to script anything. I mean, Andrako's probably still describing the panel. So again, listeners, just because there's no words in an issue doesn't mean the writer didn't work just as hard. It's always collaborative. It's always 50-50, writer and artist. But being able to tell a story without any words, just through facial expression and imagery, he's never done it better. We saw it in issue 21 where Kara was sitting on this haystack and Superman flies up and asks her not to go. And there's like a series of five or six panels. And you can literally see her expression on her face change as she's going through these. It's almost like she's running through a pro and con list in her head. And you can see the conflicting emotions. Maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe he's right. I should respect him. He's my cousin. He's Superman. But all the people that I love that died. And you could just see there's no words, and you can just see her go through this range of emotions until in the last panel, her face is kind of set in this expression that shows her resolve to go and do this. And I thought that was amazing work from Kevin Maguire. In this issue, it's that four panel sequence where she reaches for the axe, it zaps her. And then you can see, in the next one, she's just holding out one finger and she's thinking, should I touch this again? Is it going to shock me? And then she does touch it and she's like, okay. And then the last panel, she's kind of surprised because she gets surrounded by this Green Lantern bubble. Again, there's no words, but you know exactly what's going on just from looking at the art and the facial expressions. And it's masterfully done. So from Kevin Maguire on pencils to Sean Parsons on inks, Placencia on colors, keeping it in kind of in that wheelhouse of Supergirl. She may not be as bright and chipper and happy and hopeful as we normally see her, but the colors still are, which in a way kind of juxtaposes with the stories that's being told, but it makes it still feel like a Supergirl book. And it also makes it feel very cosmic, to Adam's point earlier. I think Supergirl very much works as a cosmic character. So for me, the art in this is absolutely amazing. And I can't wait for more, and I can't wait to see Supergirl continue this evolution of wearing different costumes, because they just look super cool.
I agree with all that. I also want to say, while we're talking about Kara's expressions, we also got to talk about how good Crypto's expressions are too, because that's almost a whole different skill.
Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah, good on you for bringing that up. It's not like we ever get actual crypto dialogue. So being able to show...
No more thought bubbles.
Right, exactly. And being able to show what he's thinking. I wonder how much reference he's using for that. I did see a couple of creators on Twitter recently wondering what kind of species or what breed, rather, Crypto was. I think it was Brad Walker and Doc Shaner. They're like, what exactly is Crypto? Because, man, Crypto's beloved.
Yeah, he's a good boy.
So I'm glad. I wonder whose idea that was to bring Crypto in, if that was something Andrako wanted from the start, or how exactly that came about. Because, yeah, they're a great combo, Supergirl and Crypto, for sure. I think they work better together than Superman and Crypto do. And I'm that's coming from somebody who loves a boy and his dog kind of thing.
Right.
I think probably Crypto works like best with John Kent, because that literally is a boy and his dog. But just a notch below that is Supergirl or Kara and Crypto for me.
I don't know if I'm ready to say that it's better than Crypto and Clark combination, but I kind of feel like I'm happy they didn't use Streaky, the cat.
Yeah, or they could have used Comet as well, because they've done that in the past where it's been Kara and her horse. But I think it works best with Crypto.
Yep, I agree.
All right, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Anything else you want to say about issue 22, Adam?
No, not right now.
All right. Well, once again, we want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. And don't forget, next show I'll be at is New York Comic Con, the first week of October, Thursday through Sunday. So be sure you're following along on Instagram for all kinds of creator interviews and cool pictures and panel coverage and all that kind of stuff. So once again, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.